Today is Thursday, March 15th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, thousands of students around the nation walk out of class to protest gun violence. The U.S. says it stands in solidarity with Britain over Russia's alleged poisoning of a man and his daughter.
They have provided no credible explanation that could suggest they lost control of their nerve agent.
Also ahead, conservationists worry about progress after the U.S. reverses a ban on animal trophies from Africa. It's all on today's International Edition. Tens of thousands of students across the United States, many chanting enough is enough, walked out of their schools Wednesday to protest congressional failure to directly address gun violence. The protest began around 10 a.m. in the morning, local time, at about 3,000 schools. Most lasted for 17 minutes, 1 minute for each massacre victim of Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, 1 month ago Wednesday.
It directly affects us. We are the future. We are students. There's no reason for us not to be accepting this responsibility. So that's why I felt like it was more we had to be here, not an option.
There are also protests outside the U.S. Capitol. Many teachers, parents, and school administrators took part in the global walkout. Joining us now to talk more about what has happened since the February 14th school shooting is Mark Rozell, dean of the Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. What is your reaction to all this activism we've been seeing since that horrible day?
This is a real political movement that's developing, and amazingly, it is being energized by very young people. Those in the United States who traditionally have been the most apolitical, apathetic, and once they reach adulthood, the least likely to actually vote in election. But this latest tragedy that occurred in Florida, I think, has had a profound impact on young people across the country. And that was being seen very clearly in the demonstrations where tens of thousands of students walked out of class to show solidarity on the issue of needing tighter gun control and other measures in order to, frankly, protect people like themselves. I think all these students see it as, that could have been me, that could have been my friend. And they're motivated to do something about it. And this may be a real impetus for long-term political activism by a number of young people, which would be quite a big turn in American society.
And particularly with the gun issue, it just seems like every time something would happen under President Obama's watch, he would put it out there and nothing would ever happen. It just didn't seem like there was the political will. And of course, we know the National Rifle Association has a lot of money at stake with these politicians. And it sounded to me from some of the speeches from these kids who were obviously very well informed, very well educated on these issues, talked about how the next death and blood will be on the hands of not just the National Rifle Association, but all the politicians who put money and power ahead of their lives. I was just blown away by some of these statements they were making.
The students are making some very, very powerful statements, and they are heavily focused on politicians who vote pro-gun rights, interest group organizations, particularly the NRA, who have a very substantial influence on public policies regarding guns issues in the United States at the state and federal levels. And they're making the clear connection between interest group activity, voting in Congress, voting in state legislatures, and in their view, the tragedies that have taken place as a result of what they see as very lax gun laws in this country. And so they are expressing their fervent commitment to get out and demonstrate and ultimately vote on this issue to try to change the trajectory in this country. I mean, look at the statistics. It's quite shocking, the number of mass shootings that have taken place over the past several years. And then, of course, you have the president saying, arm the teachers. That just doesn't work for the educators, and the students, I think, are just exasperated. Therefore, they just wanted to get out and express themselves, and they did in a big way.
And they certainly called out the president by name, saying your solution is to put more guns out there. They're not afraid to stand up to the president.
Right. The young people are saying they want leadership. They want their elected leaders to stand up and do something about this problem in a serious way and not continue talking about our thoughts and prayers are with you, or maybe we should give guns to teachers. You don't have to be a sophisticated adult to know these are not serious solutions to the problem. And the problem is just going to continue unless some real policy solutions are put forth that have some realistic chance of putting restrictions on different types of weapons of mass murder that will prevent future tragedies like this. Again, I think this is deeply personal for the students. They understand that could have been them, that could have been their friends, and they're doing the very American thing, right? Getting out and protesting, expressing themselves, and trying to change the direction of the country in this area.
Given that you are an educator, even though it's on the college level, if you were a high school teacher, would you be supportive of your students walking out to make this statement?
Absolutely. Absolutely, I would. You know, this is a moment in American political history and culture that I think one day of class lessons should not get in the way. Young people wanting to get out, mobilize, express themselves, become a part of the process. Look, we educators have been complaining for years that the young people are apathetic and they're not participating in a high enough rate in the political system. And now they want to do so. And some educators actually told students, you will get detention, you will be penalized if you step out of class for a couple of hours to show solidarity with those who were murdered. No doubt, let the students get out there. I think there's a better lesson there than anything we can, you know, with our textbooks in those 2 hours that students have used to leave school and express themselves.
That's Mark Rozelle, Dean of the Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. And turning now to the social media aspect of the story, we're joined by VOA's Doug Bernard. Doug, the movement really growing exponentially, and I think in large part probably due to the far reach of social media.
What's fascinating is if you look at Instagram and Snapchat, and of course, you know, Twitter and Facebook and whatnot, you'll see very, very popular either hashtag never again or hashtag national school walkout. Tens of thousands of students across the United States at hundreds of high schools organized this national day of activism. They all did it via social media. If you look across the web, there are countless maps of who's doing what and how to get in contact with so-and-so. It's frequently impressive. These are young people who really organized on themselves, by themselves, and have a genuine kind of consistent message. So it's been fascinating to watch how this has rippled across social media and how they've used it and how they will continue to use it into the future.
Looks like social media is certainly becoming a platform for change, and people want to see change.
Well, it's certainly a platform for connection, and I think that's the key point. So of all of these young people, they're using these tools, using them in a way to organize for something more than just, you know, a fleeting moment. I think this is very interesting. We'll have to watch and see what happens. This is a very interesting use of social media.
All right, Doug, thank you. You can follow him at DFrontiers. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. U.S. regulators look into the death of a dog on a United Airlines flight. The U.S. rejects Iranian accusations of supporting Afghan IS. Turkey's uneasy over the firing of Rex Tillerson as a U.S. diplomat. And Toys R Us will shut down or sell all of its U.S. stores. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Well, in the strongest remarks from a Trump administration official yet, U.S. Ambassador Nikki Haley told the U.N. Security Council Wednesday that the United States stands in solidarity with Great Britain over accusations that Russia is responsible for poisoning a Russian spy and his daughter in the U.K.
If the Russian government stopped using chemical weapons to assassinate its enemies, and if the Russian government stopped helping its Syrian ally to use chemical weapons to kill Syrian children, and if Russia cooperated with the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons by turning over all information related to this nerve agent, we would stop talking about them.
Britain says it will take action after Moscow shrugged off demands to explain how the deadly Soviet-era nerve agent was used in an English town to poison the two. Prime Minister Theresa May spoke to the House of Commons Wednesday.
This represents an unlawful use of force by the Russian state against the United Kingdom. And as I set out on Monday, it has taken place against the backdrop of a well-established pattern of Russian state aggression across Europe and beyond.
Reporter Jamie Detmer tells International Edition's Sarah Williams about the British reprisals against Moscow.
The immediate measure was the expulsion of 23 diplomats, Russian diplomats from London, who the British government say are in fact undeclared Russian intelligence officers. This will be the biggest expulsion of diplomats from the UK since the height of the Cold War, actually 1971, when over 90 were expelled by the then Labour government. That's the most immediate one. But there are a raft of other measures that she's talking about, which mainly focused on financial, whereby legislation that's already to hand, they're going to start investigating Russian assets. A lot of oligarchs close to the Kremlin, as well as the inner circle of Mr. Putin, own property in London, in Britain, very expensive property. And there are lots of their dollars and rubles in assets held by the banks as well. So if someone cannot really explain where their wealth comes from, or there is a suspicion of corruption, the British government can start seizing assets, and they will start doing so, I suspect, as this unfolds. They're talking about new anti-espionage measures. They're talking about increased monitoring, tracking of Russians flying in from overseas, which means some visa bans will come. And very significantly, they have decided to suspend all high-level contacts between British officials and Russian officials, including stopping a planned visit by the foreign minister from Russia, Sergei Lavrov. They've left the ambassador in place at the moment and not expelled him, partly because they need to have some kind of communication conduit as this all plays out.
I believe that Britain wanted the Russians to respond to their questions concerning this poisoning. I don't believe there's been any official response yet.
Well, the official response was, we're not responding. They were given until midnight Wednesday, Tuesday night Wednesday, to explain why this military-grade nerve agent, the British says was used in the attack, Novichok, which was developed in the Soviet era in labs in the 1970s, 1980s at laboratories in Russia, why that was present in the UK. And they were given this choice, either say that you approved this killing or that you lost control of this. Now, the response from the Russians has been, we're not going to respond. You should go through different channels. There are a variety of international channels you can go through. We'd also want a sample of this nerve agent before you respond. They have responded, however, officially to the reprisals, saying the foreign ministry a couple of hours ago said that there would be a response. So I think that what we will see is a tit-for-tat expulsion of British diplomats from Moscow. And this really means that we're going to see an escalation for a while in this confrontation.
I watched some of Prime Minister May's comments on television, and I noticed the response in Parliament seemed very supportive, no matter which party the members were from.
Yes, yeah, she clearly does have support of the House of Commons, and came under a lot of political pressure in the last few days to take strong action. The political dynamic in the UK is getting more and more angry towards the Russians because of suggestions from a Soviet-era chemical warfare expert who helped develop this nerve agent, who now lives in America, saying that, in fact, hundreds of people may have been exposed during this attack to trace contamination, and they will have health risks for the rest of their lives. So as well as people being angry that the government hasn't responded possibly enough to a healthcare crisis, there is a lot of anger building up in the UK towards Russia.
All right, that's Jamie Detmer, a London-based journalist. Conservationists say the U.S.'s recent lifting of a ban on imports of some African animal trophies sends the wrong message. Elephant poaching for ivory in Kenya alone has been reduced from a recent high of 103 killed in 2012 to 8 killed last year, according to a USAID-supported program. Big game trophy hunting advocates argue the high fees they pay, up to $100,000 per safari, directly benefit conservation efforts. But critics of trophy hunting say most of that money actually goes to organizers of the hunts. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service recently overturned Obama-era restrictions on imports of some African hunting trophies, including parts of lions and elephants. Joining us now is Tanya Sanarib, senior attorney for the Center for Biological Diversity. What can you tell us about this recent decision?
You know, my first reaction is worldwide, countries are considering and implementing ivory bans. And the U.S. has now sent this message that we're backtracking. We sent this mixed message, right, that we want to help stop elephant poaching, but some people, U.S. wealthy hunters, still get to kill elephants. That mixed message does not bode well for wildlife.
My understanding is that African elephants have been listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act since 1979. How is it that they're even allowed?
I absolutely think that trophy hunting goes against our Endangered Species Act. And the way that hunters can import trophies of imperiled species into the U.S. is under a theory called pay to play. Basically, what the hunters do is they say, we pay so much money and it benefits wildlife that we should be allowed to do something that otherwise is illegal.
Is this the case for other species as well here in the, as far as trophy hunting, as far as endangered species in the United States?
You asked about the legality of these actions under the Endangered Species Act, and that's a very big question, whether or not it's lawful for a trophy hunter to pay to play, whether they get to do that. The language of the act is very different. It actually talks about an activity that someone wants to engage in with an imperiled species, having that activity be beneficial itself, like the California Condor Reintroduction Program. Obviously, going out and killing an imperiled animal is completely different from that and raises really significant legal concerns. We, for one, at the center, don't think that pay-to-play is legal.
Are you taking legal action to try to fight this decision? Are other groups doing anything to try to fight this reversal? I know that there have been millions of people really upset about it, but I'm not aware of what's being done in any sort of legal sense.
After the lifting of the Zimbabwe elephant trophy ban was announced last November, within a handful of days, we sued the administration. We took them to court and we said, this decision is illegal. We did that for elephants. They also made a decision to allow lion trophies to come in from Zimbabwe. We sued over both of those decisions. A lot has happened since then. We have a new memo from this administration in response to a court decision in which the administration says, the court just told us to involve the public in these decisions, and you want to know what? We're going to try not to do that. We're going to try a different tactic. We're taking a hard look at that memo to decide if we can bring it into court as well.
We know that their numbers are declining rapidly, something like 62% over the past decade. That number apparently growing according to some statistics. What can you tell us about the numbers worldwide?
We're in the midst of an elephant poaching crisis. And as I said earlier, in response to that, we've had a worldwide push to try to ban the ivory trade. Countries all over the world, including some of the biggest ivory consumers like China and Hong Kong, are talking about implementing ivory bans. So for the U.S. in the face of that worldwide momentum to say some really rich people in the U.S. can still do this activity is incredibly damaging. Elephants are protected under our Endangered Species Act domestically in the U.S. Internationally, they're protected by an international agreement that addresses trade in imperiled species. This treaty is called CITES. And long ago, when CITES was first being implemented, the trophy hunters got to the parties to the agreement and said, yeah, elephants at that point in time were going down the tube in the 1970s. We understand you want to ban the ivory trade, but give us an exception. We just want to kill an elephant and take it home and hang it in our house. It's personal use. It's not going to enter the commercial market, so we want an exception. They got that exception. So while countries talk, and we talk about internationally this ivory ban, trophy hunters have an exception. They are the one entity that's allowed to still trade in ivory. Really important that we start looking at that because it's becoming a concern for someone to pose as a trophy hunter, go and kill an elephant, take that quote-unquote trophy, those ivory tusks, back to their country, and then they can sell them. They can use them. Even though it's illegal, they can still launder them into the black market. I think the biggest thing that people can do is continue to show their outrage on this issue. Obviously, it swayed the president back in the fall. We need to sway him again. And this time, we need to keep the pressure on until this administration actually takes action, actually bans imports of elephant trophies.
That's Tanya Sanarib. Thank you for being with us. She's a senior attorney for the Center for Biological Diversity. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hey there, this is Shauna Renee, the lady DJ and host of Soul Lounge. Every Sunday at 1400 UTC, I choose an artist that you and I love, and we break down their entire career while listening to their biggest hits. That's what we do here on the Soul Lounge. Once again, every Sunday, 1400 UTC, right here.
VOA's International Edition continues. Physicist Stephen Hawking died Wednesday at his home in Cambridge, England, at the age of 76. He was one of the most respected and best-known scientists in modern history, Arash Arabasadi reports.
British theoretical physicist Stephen Hawking was known for his work ranging from the origins of the universe to attributes of black holes. Confined to a wheelchair due to a rare motor neuron disease, Hawking was given just a few years to live when he was only 22.
I want to report that I think I have solved a major problem in theoretical physics that has been around since I discovered that black holes radiate thermally 30 years ago.
His illness took from Hawking his mobility and left him largely unable to speak without help from a voice synthesizer.
Yet if, as I hope, basic science becomes part of general awareness, what now appear as the paradoxes of quantum theory will seem as just common sense to our children's children.
Hawking was also a pop culture icon who appeared on Star Trek The Next Generation as well as animated series like Futurama and The Simpsons. In 2007, the man who said the human race had no future without going into space experienced flight without gravity.
I have long wanted to go into space, and a zero-gravity flight is the first step towards space travel. As you can imagine, I am very excited. I have been wheelchair-bound for almost 4 decades, and the chance to float free in zero-G will be wonderful. See you in zero-G.
Hawking was married and divorced twice. He is survived by 3 children. The legendary physicist met various heads of state, was the subject of a major motion picture, and received the Medal of Freedom in 2009 from then-President Barack Obama. And yet, he never won a Nobel Prize. His theoretical findings required millions of dollars and years to even build the technology to observe his findings. He died on March 14th, which is International Pi Day, in honor of the mathematical constant. As the universe would have it, it's also Albert Einstein's birthday. See you in zero G. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
And now for a look at the latest Hollywood movies to hit U.S. theaters. We're joined by Vegas film critic Jeffrey K. Howard. Hey, Jeff. So I know you just saw Tomb Raiders. Tell us about it.
This is the reboot from the Angelina Jolie film, remember from years ago? I was never a fan of that movie, and I still get people upset with me when I tell them I don't like that film, because I was never into video games. I was in the original days in the 80s, but video games, I think they're silly. I don't play them. So this is superhero from a very popular game series, and we have director Roar Uthog, who's Norwegian, believe it or not, and Alicia Vikander, who's Swedish, playing Lara Croft. And what's really cool about this version, yes, it's an action adventure. Yes, it's like a video game. Yes, it seems like Raiders of the Lost Ark and National Treasure most of the time, but they did something different with Lara Croft. Alicia plays her like a human, meaning she has flaws, she feels pain, she doesn't have a plan of what she's doing, she's intelligent, but she's reckless, she's foolhardy. So when you're watching this movie, it quickly you're like, wow, there's such realism in this. It's just not Hollywood hoopla, you know, where she can get up after being beaten up by 2 people and no bruises and all that. So this really has some really cool realism to it. And it's a fun adventure. It really is. I had a good time with it. I really did. I thought I was going to come in and kind of like, but Alicia Vikander sells this film. I hope they make sequels, because she is just an awesome action hero, and it's a good time.
Wow, that's quite the endorsement. Glad to hear it. So what about this horror flick? I'm scared enough in real life, so.
Well, this is a very hardcore horror film. It's called Strangers Pray at Night. It's a sequel, I guess you could call it that, from 10 years ago called The Strangers, where the Strangers did a home invasion against Liv Tyler and her husband. And they have masks on. They're called Dollface, Pinup Girl, and Man in a Mask, which is really Bagface. So you have this trailer park that's been abandoned, that's been closed down, and this family, two teenagers and the parents, go down to help their uncle close it down. They get there late at night, and our three murderous psychopaths show up and start causing terror. So the movie has tension, it has mood, it has gore. The third act, it kind of falls apart, and, but there's no rhyme or reason for the murder, you know? Even one of the characters says, why are you doing this? She's like, why not? The characters are stupid most of the time. So there's been a big argument on the internet about this movie. Is it a satire, or is it a cliche of horror films? I think, you know, of course it's a cliche, but most of the time it delivers the fear. It really does. And the guy who directed it, Johannes Roberts, did 47 Meters Down, which was the most popular indie film from last year. And you know what? I had a good time with it. I really did. If you like that kind of thing, but if you have delicate sensibilities, I wouldn't recommend the film because it is bloody, it is gory, and it's very realistic.
All right, Jeffrey K. Howard, follow him on Twitter or actually find his full video reviews at VegasFilmCritic.com. That does it for today's show. Thank you so much for joining us. You can find us anytime at VOAnews.com. Thank you so much to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
30 years ago, on March 16, 1988, and just before the start of the Al-Anfal operation, the regime of then-president of Iraq, Saddam Hussein, committed one of the worst atrocities of the modern era, the murder by poison gas of thousands of civilians in the Kurdish-Iraqi town of Halabja. As part of a genocidal campaign against the Kurds and other ethnic groups in northern Iraq, government forces spent 2 days shelling the city of Halabja with rockets and napalm, an incendiary gel that sticks to skin and causes terrible burns. On the second day, March 16th, they suddenly changed tactics. Attacking aircraft began to pepper the civilian parts of the city with canisters of chemical weapons, including mustard gas and the nerve agent sarin, Tabin, and VX. That day, some 3,500 to 5,000 people died within minutes. Another 7,000 to 10,000 were injured, crippled, or suffered long-term health problems. Although there is some evidence that Saddam Hussein's forces had used chemical agents before March 16, 1988, the attack on Halabja is thought to be the first documented assault by Saddam Hussein's forces using chemical weapons. But it would not be the last. Early in 1987, Saddam Hussein authorized the use of chemical weapons in attacks on as many as 24 Kurdish villages. For his role in these heinous attacks, the dictator's cousin and the campaign's commander, Ali Hassan al-Majid, earned the nickname Chemical Ali. The Al-Anfal campaign was a series of horrific crimes perpetrated by Iraqi leaders against their own civilian population. The gassing of the citizens of Halabja was one of the worst atrocities perpetrated by Saddam Hussein against his own people. For his part in it and for other crimes, Chemical Ali was executed by hanging. The Iraqi Special Tribunal dropped charges against Saddam Hussein himself, only because he was executed after being convicted in a separate case. The head of government has a responsibility to the country and to its people to act in their best interest. Ultimately, few dictators die in bed or exit the scene of their crimes gracefully. The fate of those who instigated the Al-Anfal and killed thousands of innocents in Halabja should serve as a warning to others who follow in their murderous footsteps.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.